Two NPR correspondents are making a journey across America this fall. One is moving east, the other moving west, and they're talking with Americans about the changing economy and the long, uncertain, often bitter tail end of the Great Recession.
Today, this hard times journey takes us to Huntsville, Alabama. It's doing better than some places. Unlike the county that includes Birmingham, which filed for bankruptcy yesterday, the town of Huntsville has a balanced budget.
The trouble involves the near future in a city that has been all about the future. Huntsville calls itself Rocket City, USA. It is the town that helped put man on the moon, a high-tech enclave in a poor state. But with NASA downsizing and the specter of automatic defense cuts looming, Huntsville finds itself in limbo. NPR's Debbie Elliott has our story.
Driving into Huntsville, it's clear what this city is all about. A giant Saturn V rocket looms ahead in the skyline. It's on the grounds of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, where you can travel back to 1965.
Automatic countdown sequence has started.
This is the city that made the Saturn rockets that launched the Apollo astronauts to the moon.
Three, two, one, ignition.
And you have just heard the Saturn V rockets take off and put man into space. You know, and it's kind of neat. We're the only place in the world that still has expertise about going into deep space.
That's Huntsville Mayor Tommy Battle. He says that moment turned what was then a rural farming community on its ear. And the city has been on a high-tech growth spurt ever since, now a metropolitan area with 400,000 people. Battle meets me at the Space and Rocket Center under a giant model of the Saturn V, and you can hear it rumbling in the background. He says that's a familiar sound to longtime residents.
You'd hear that in the middle of the night. They'd be out on a test stand and they'd go and it'd shake the whole community. One time somebody said, I'm not sure I like that shaking the community. And everybody said, no, it sounds like cash registers ringing to me.
But the sound in Huntsville is quieter today.
If you go through the offices where I'm at, it's like a ghost town. There's empty cubes all over the place.
Engineer Greg Allison works for a space contractor. He says scaling back space exploration is tragic for Huntsville and the nation.
This is talent that can turn our country around. We have enormous capabilities here. If we would just get our act together, we can still shine, we can perform, we can do things that nobody else can.
Huntsville's unemployment rate is 8.2%, below the national average, but double typical jobless figures here. The situation has laid off engineers and scientists banding together.
Andy!
Oh, hey, guys.
Andy Sutenen greets members of Huntsville Space Professionals, a group he founded when he lost his job last year.
People get laid off. It's like rats leaving a ship. You know, everyone heads off in their own direction, and you feel like, you know, is it my fault? So I realized, no, it's not, and it's not really your fault. You're just a number, really.
Sutenen, who is 55, has since found another job, but that's not the case for many of the 1,000 members of his club.
My name is Brian Floyd, and I am a space mechanisms designer.
He's been out of work a year now at 61.
The age thing is a major consideration. I got laid off and my son got laid off exactly the same day. We're holding pink slips looking at each other. And he got a job right away. And I've had lots of interviews and I can't get anything.
Age and experience typically get you ahead in aerospace, but maybe not so much anymore. Karen Murphy is 40 and lost her job a month ago.
I've never seen it this hopeless.
She says the town is full of smart and dedicated people who need things to do, and blames a lack of leadership in Washington.
We're all very aware of what the elections next year mean.
Yeah.
Both parties have very different ideas, and neither set of ideas seems to be doing any good. They seem to have a tremendous amount of motivation to put blocks in front of each other. That's fine when you're playing politics in Washington, but it doesn't do a darn thing when I'm trying to decide whether or not I can actually get something for somebody for Christmas this year.
Andrew Sutenen says there's a lack of political vision for NASA, which he likens to a neglected baby.
Not one of the parents, Republican or Democrats, said, that's important to us. Our genius baby that can help us with our future is not talked about. That tells everybody that the future is dim, you know, no matter who's in office. And on top of that, both parents have no money, you know.
And that's not simply a problem for the aerospace industry. Just across the interstate from the Space and Rocket Center is one of the biggest research parks in the country. Nestled beside cotton fields and cow pastures is a slew of defense contractors. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and hundreds more.
Everyone's got an eye on Washington. Huntsville always has an eye on Washington.
Lee Roop is a reporter with the Huntsville Times.
Everyone's watching the Super Committee. Everyone's watching the impasse in Congress. What's going to happen? Where is the defense program going to go next?
If the Congressional Super Committee doesn't come up with a plan, more than $500 billion in automatic defense cuts will kick in. Roop notes that politically, voters here like the idea of budget cuts in general.
Alabama's a red state. This is a conservative area. Folks here do have the same concerns that people have everywhere about the budget and what's going to happen. I think they would tell you that this community does vital federal work. You know, there's government spending and then there's our government spending. So,
with nearly half the city's jobs dependent on space and defense spending, that's certainly the message from Huntsville Mayor Tommy Battle.
We're developing the kind of things that you have to have if you're going to be a more efficient Army, if you're going to be a more efficient NASA.
Whatever happens with the federal budget, Battle remains optimistic. He says Huntsville survived a severe blow to its economy in the 1970s when the Apollo program shut down.
Left a lot of engineers here without jobs, and all of a sudden, you know, those engineers, some of them moved away, some of them said, I'm staying here. And out of their basements came four Fortune 500 companies, because you left an engineer alone long enough that he decided, I got to do something, so I'm going to start a company.
There are similar rumblings underway today. At the end of a Huntsville space professionals meeting last week, founder Andy Sutenen had some news.
Christos. Christos. I'm going to be starting a company, so...
That's great.
And Chris is going to be part of this company. We're hiring Brian and Herb, and I'd like to get you to be part of the company.
So we have the talent, he says, to go from helping people find jobs to creating jobs ourselves. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
I want to let you know that you can follow our Hard Times series on Twitter at NPR Hard Times. I just now started following myself. You can also follow this program at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. Here in the United States, two airlines are pioneering the use of biofuels. On Monday, a Continental flight from Houston to Chicago was powered with a fuel made partly from algae. And today, Alaska Airlines will fly passengers using a biofuel blend made partly from cooking oil. Bellamy Palethorpe, a member station KPLU in Seattle, reports on the challenges of shifting the airline industry to alternative fuels.
In recent years, the Alaska Air Group has focused on fuel efficiency to keep costs down and help the environment.
USO the Puget Sound is always open and located on the mezzanine level of the main terminal.
At SeaTac Airport, the airline's Director of Government Relations, Megan Lawrence, is standing near her employer's ticket counter. She lists off innovations like fog-busting satellite technology, used to land in hard-to-reach locations and make flight paths more efficient.
So the next kind of big thing on the horizon, because efficiency can only get us so far in terms of reducing our carbon footprint, is the biofuels arena.
She says the biofuel they'll be using will provide a 10% reduction in carbon emissions compared to conventional jet fuel. They've bought enough for 75 flights to Washington, D.C. and Portland, Oregon, and she promises they won't pass any extra costs on to consumers. But this next step in Alaska Air's evolution isn't exactly the gold standard of green. This particular batch is sourced from used cooking oil that's not even local. It comes from deep fryers in Texas and is processed in New Orleans.
My name is Dean Williams, and I operate the fuel facility for SeaTac Airport.
Williams is a chemist who presides over what's essentially a huge gas station. He says Alaska Air's new biofuel will come via rail car and tanker truck, both of which increase the carbon footprint. But he says this batch of fuel is not really that different from conventional jet fuel. And in case you're wondering, it doesn't smell like French fries.
It smells a little better than the gas station in here. We have good air conditioning in here and good quality control, but that's one of the things about jet fuel. It is safe and clean and very highly regulated as far as quality.
Williams says you can blend in up to 50% biofuel if it passes certain chemical tests. With him is Bill Glover, Boeing's strategist for environmental policy. He says different airlines have different ways of reducing the air pollution they create. But before they can do that most effectively, the industry has to build a whole new supply chain for biofuels.
It's going to take a little while to get the infrastructure in place, get the volume up, and get some of the economics more favorable. But our near-term target is 1% of all the aviation fuel to have some bio content by 2015.
Why?
Richard Abulafia is an aviation analyst with the Teal Group in Fairfax, Virginia. He thinks real progress is at least 15 years away.
What you've got is somewhere between advanced showmanship and expensive subsidies.
Abulafia says Alaska's demonstration project might not be getting direct subsidies, but the whole industry is getting huge tax breaks. Boeing's Bill Glover counters it's crucial for the biofuels industry to get this kind of support because air travel is only growing, as is the pressure to become energy independent and reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
We realize we have to take action to make sure that we keep carbon emissions small and find ways to actually, you know, drive them towards zero.
But right now, one of the things slowing that drive is the price. Alaska Air's biofuel costs nearly 6 times as much as conventional jet fuel. And the company is only willing to absorb the cost of a small number of demonstration flights, like the ones that take off later today. For NPR News, I'm Bellamy Palethorpe in Seattle.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi says he's going to resign. He promises to do so after an economic overhaul is approved in his country. This announcement comes amid European concerns over Italy's solvency following the Greek debt crisis. The contagion is spreading. Yesterday, Berlusconi lost the support of his political majority during a key budget vote in Parliament. And we're going to talk about all this with NPR's Silvia Poggioli, who is on the line from Rome. Hi, Silvia.
Hi, Steve.
Remind us of the events that got Berlusconi in trouble here.
Well, he's been under intense pressure for weeks now from the opposition parties in Italy, from Italy's EU partners in Brussels, and also from he's had a lot of rebels within his own party demanding that he step down. What happened is a routine bill was passed, but there were more people abstaining than there were actually voting in favor. And that was just the visible proof that he had lost his majority in Parliament.
And this has all happened at a moment when Italy, which is buying bonds, borrowing money, is having to pay higher and higher interest rates because of concern about the possibility that Italy, like Greece, could get in severe, severe trouble here.
Absolutely. And Berlusconi has lost the confidence of the markets and of his EU partners. They've made no secret that they want him to step down.
Okay. He said he won't step down immediately, but after these budget reforms are passed. When would that be?
Well, we don't know. The bill was originally supposed to be presented to the Senate next Tuesday, and then it would also have to pass the lower house. That could take another week. Berlusconi is clearly playing for time. He wants early elections. He doesn't want so that he could stay as a caretaker, and that would allow him to influence political events. This clashes with the desires of the opposition parties and of Italy's EU partners, who want a national unity government. So although he has said he's going to resign, Italy is still in for a period of uncertainty in which he could try to regain control, even though he has lost his majority in Parliament.
I want to understand what it was that got Italy to this point, Silvia Poggioli, because, of course, it's got immense debt. But we've also heard in recent weeks and months that their current budget situation is actually not that bad. Is Italy actually close to defaulting on debts?
Until July, nobody was bothering about Italy. And yes, theoretically, they said it has a huge debt, but its deficit is much smaller than many other European countries. The economy was still okay. It has been very stagnant in growth. But clearly, with the Greek crisis escalating, Greece is a much smaller country. It can still be bailed out. Italy's much bigger, and the EU cannot bail it out. The IMF cannot bail it out. And the market started looking at Berlusconi. You know, you could almost use the old slogan, it's the Silvio stupid, and he has been at the center of this crisis.
Well, what are Italians saying?
Well, you know, the mood is very confused here. If you look at the traditionally anti-Berlusconi media in sectors, there's, of course, a sense of glee. But the man has been described as the Houdini of Italian politics. He's survived many times in the past. And the real problem is that there's very little information or transparency. Everything is rumor, can't be confirmed. The official government spokesman has not appeared in public for weeks, if not months. When Berlusconi wants to make his views known, he picks up the phone and calls into a live TV talk show. So there's still a lot of anxiety and uncertainty until he steps down.
So you're saying this is being driven by the markets. The markets hate uncertainty, of course, and what we have here is even more uncertainty for a moment.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting that perhaps in the end it's not going to be the sex scandals or his trials for corruption or tax fraud, but what will probably in the end put him out of power will be the markets. And he would be then the most high-profile victim of the Eurozone crisis.
NPR's Silvia Pagioli is in Rome. Silvia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
So the markets forced Berlusconi to say he will resign, but today financial markets seem less eager than ever to loan money to Italy at affordable rates. Italy continues issuing 10-year bonds, borrowing, and the cost of borrowing has gone up again. This morning, the effective interest rate that Italy has to pay rose to more than 7%. That is widely seen as a tipping point. When Portugal, Ireland, and Greece saw the same borrowing rate, those countries had to ask their European partners for a bailout.
Greece is still struggling to form a temporary coalition government, and the stakes could not be higher. Its economy is in shambles, with default a real possibility, something that could ripple through Europe's struggling economy. The problem is lawmakers in Greece can't agree on who should lead that government. Joanna Kakissis is following developments from Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, when we last spoke, and that was just a couple of days ago, it looked like this was all settled. There was a favorite to be the new prime minister, and seemed like it would all happen within hours. Why is there no new prime minister yet?
Well, the man that everybody thought would be prime minister, he's an economist and a former vice president of the European Central Bank, that's Lucas Papadimos. And right now, his candidacy is all up in the air because of political bickering.
And so if he has fallen out of favor, in a sense, who else is being mentioned?
Well, the latest frontrunner is actually a judge, and he's the president of the European Court of Justice. His name is Vasilis Skouris. It's anybody's guess whether he's going to be selected or not. That's just the name that's been appearing this morning in the Greek press. Another person that's been mentioned is Apostolos Kaklamanis. He is a former president of the parliament, and he's sort of a beloved grandfatherly figure in Greece. But he's not as serious of a candidate as the judge, the European Court of Justice president.
Now, what is at stake here in the sense that what is this new prime minister supposed to do?
I mean, quite simply, he's supposed to save the country from defaulting. You know, he's supposed to implement the bailout agreement. And I say he because no women have been mentioned, you know, by the way, all men. The fighting among politicians is now endangering the latest installment of the bailout. If Greece doesn't get that money, it's about $11 billion. If Greece doesn't get that money, it's not going to be able to pay its bills in December, and it's going to default. And then all the chaos will begin. So it's the government and the prime minister has a very focused and specific goal to do. But the coalition government and the interim prime minister has to cut through all the partisan bickering that's keeping that behind.
And what at this stage of the game are Greeks saying about this? I mean, it's quite a mess.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody is very, very frustrated. One commentator called it playground politics and said politicians should all be locked in a room until they come up with an agreement. Another said it shows just how bankrupt, not Greece is, but the politics are as well. I mean, the politicians the commentator said the politicians are so self-serving that they've forgotten that their goal is to actually save the country. On the ground, Greeks are saying, you know, what's going to happen? What's going to be next? And some of them are trying to be funny about it. And, you know, one satirical television program said, hey, how about Chuck Norris as prime minister? Somebody's got to go in there and do some fighting. But the Greeks themselves are just like, we don't know what we're going to wake up to the next day. It could be more deadlock, or it could be bankruptcy. It could be, we don't know. It's very, very frustrating. And it's the sense of insecurity is really worrying Greeks.
Well, it's also would seem to be worrying the rest of Europe, looking at how this is not unfolding very neatly there in Greece.
Yeah, I mean, the Europeans are clearly very frustrated with the Greeks not being able to come up with a coalition government and a name for prime minister. And what's been very clear from the Europeans is they want Greece to commit to a program. They don't want people say, we're going to do this, and then we're going to back away because it's politically, the political cost is too hard and it's too high and we can't do it. They want people to say, we have to do these things in this agreement, otherwise there are going to be very serious repercussions.
Joanna Kakissis joined us from Athens. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the early history of the birth control movement with Jill Lepore. She says it's easy to think the politics surrounding the issue have always been the same as now, but
the arguments made by one side or the other have kind of switched sides over time more than once.
Lepore writes about the history of Planned Parenthood in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.